apologize if I sound a little under the weather. The sickness is going around. Not the good kind. I'm not down with the sickness. I'm just have the sickness.
Wow, that Disturbed reference.
Put in the show notes.
I shan't.
What's been going on, man? Happy Thursday. Happy recording day.
Happy Thursday. What has been going on? Let me think. I don't know. Okay, so I think last episode we talked about how we were just trying to like rehab how we felt about work, or I was at least talking about like at the end of the last year I was burnt out and I want to not be burnt out anymore.
Sure, and you talked about like creative outlets, guitar and reading and music and making programming fun again.
Yeah, yeah, it's going well. So what's been going on is that actually. So been digging into the domain-driven design book, the teal one. I'll put a link to the show notes, but been digging into that. And what's been going on is I've actually been able to apply some of the stuff I've been learning there to Design Collective's code base already. So that feels really good. And I feel like I've had better focus throughout the week. I'm stopping at five every day. I'm getting plenty of walks. I'm taking walks into the dog park twice a day. So days feel pretty productive. I don't feel bummed out anymore. And I feel like I'm having fun solving the challenges that I'm solving, maybe is what I'm getting at. So
staying hydrated.
I have water right here, actually. I haven't been training, but I've been running. So talking about like from last week, talking about Keystone Habits, I've been going to the gym with Jamie in the mornings and running. So there's that. That's been helpful too, but yeah, I don't know. It feels like things are off to a good start for the new year. So
that's great. Have you had any more time to play with Go?
Not yet. I wanted to tonight after recording a little bit. Jamie's got some extracurricular activities that she's got to do for work, so I might use that as a chance.
Extracurricular activities for work. It sounds like putting a spin on homework.
Basically. I don't think I even explained what her job is now. So she's a staff attorney and a policy analyst for a nonprofit up here in Santa Rosa. And so part of her job is to basically pay attention to what's happening, especially when it comes to like the watershed area of the Russian River up here. And so when activities are happening, she has to basically analyze what's happening, what's been being discussed. If there's any hearings or if there's like the water board is in session, she goes to that and sort of observes, and she basically analyzes legally what's happening and can advise the nonprofit on what to do. So a lot of research. She basically has to compile her own knowledge base, I suppose, in the area and, slowly become an expert in the field for this particular nonprofit. So a lot of research happening sort of after hours to help her get up to speed with the job.
Yeah. Wow. It sounds like a lot of work.
Yeah. A lot of work, a lot of reading, a lot of research. So, but it's cool though, because she's using tools. Like I looked over her shoulder the other day and she has a Notion set up and she got stuff organized in a Notion, which is pretty cool.
I love it.
Made me proud. Yeah.
I mean, it's a beautiful area. It's worth protecting.
Yeah, exactly. So that's what she's up to. But so yeah, basically homework. So I haven't toyed around too much more with Go lately. I want to. I've just been digging. Yeah, it's really like I haven't done much after work the past couple of weeks. I want to sort of try to do some of that stuff on the weekends, maybe when making sure that I'm getting enough sleep and exercise, really, without like staying up and staring at a computer. So, but yeah, just during the day, like digging into Elixir more, digging into like Design Collective's architectural design, solving some problems there. Picking up where we left off last year and sort of making those things better, I guess. So I felt like I had a pretty good breakthrough this morning. Actually, I was at the dog park. Watson didn't feel like playing fetch, so I just let him do his own thing. And I was researching some Elasticsearch stuff on my phone. And I feel like I solved a problem that I've sort of been fighting for a while.
That's pretty good. A little time to unplug will help. Kind of like the shower thought kind of thing will kind of hit you and your mind is nice and relaxed. I like that.
Yeah. I think running helps a lot too. Just standing, you know, especially on a treadmill, you're just staring and running and staring. And so it's really, my mind wanders. Even if I'm like listening to a book, my mind will wander a bit and allow me to sort of, just, you know, think about that stuff, but I'm not sitting in front of my computer, so I think it helps. I read somewhere, or I listened to a book somewhere, or someone told me at some point, I really can't remember the source of this, but a way to solve a problem is, this sounds crazy to me now, but like, you sort of lay down and you're thinking about this thing and you start to doze off, and you set a timer, or maybe you like hold something in your hand, so when you fall asleep, it hits the ground and wakes you up. But I heard, like I said, I read this or I listened to it or someone told me this, that they, when they are really stuck on a problem, they use that process to sort of help them think of out-of-the-box solutions. Because when you're dazing off or when you're starting to fall asleep, your brain can kind of like wander unhindered, right? I haven't tried that yet, but I always thought that was interesting.
It sounds like such a stupid... Like, it sounds so anti-productive, like, oh, I'm going to go take a nap.
Right.
In the middle of the day. It sounds so weird, but I mean, I totally get where that's coming from. Like you said, it's almost like rubber ducking, right? Like, you're kind of thinking about the problem without being in the problem.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
You know, instead of explaining it to someone else, you're kind of just mulling it over instead of actively trying to solve it by writing code, which... as you and I have sort of learned over the years, like, just jumping in and writing code is not always, almost always never the right thing to do when you're trying to build new things or start new architectures or try to fix problems, that kind of thing.
Yeah, it almost always has to come down to research beforehand, right? Maybe that's another thing that I've been doing. Again, we're not that far into the new year, but I've been working much slower, since returning back to work from the break, and it feels really good. And again, I think like the solving the problem that I'd been struggling with for a while, really, like, it's just an annoyance of having to sync to data stores, right? So we have our database and we have Elasticsearch, and one, you know, one has to be like the source of authority, which for us, it's our database. And then we always have to make sure that the data gets pushed back to design collect or to the Elasticsearch index. And it becomes frustrating if, I guess I can back up. Like, so I basically learned how to use Elasticsearch through the SearchKick gem. And the SearchKick gem, whenever you change, like whenever the model changes in Rails and it updates in the database, there's a callback that runs that updates the search index just in place. So I sort of carried that habit with me this whole time. Like, okay, we're in Elixir land, and when this database row is updated, we also have to make sure Elasticsearch is updated. And what ends up happening there is, if you don't have something like callbacks, which we don't really use them, we don't have any sort of magical callbacks when a row changes in our Elixir app, we have to do it on purpose, right? So then we start having this tight coupling from our product context to our Elasticsearch context, because the product context is the one that's telling the Elasticsearch context when to upload a product, right? And so you have to do this like all the time, and it's really, really frustrating. So I feel like I haven't really stepped back enough to actually find a better approach to that, because I was just concerned with shipping stuff more quickly, you know, and not taking enough time to look at prior artwork. And yeah, so when I did just step back and take a look and be like, okay, well, let me just Google, like, what are strategies for syncing Elasticsearch in a database? Well, then I had a pretty clear immediate answer. Elastic itself had a blog post describing several different strategies and some anti-patterns. So if I would have just done that 3 months ago or 6 months ago, I wouldn't have to be dealing with it right now, you know? So taking, you know, forcing myself, like you said, to sort of step outside of the problem and research or look for prior art really helped me there. And I don't know why I don't do it more often.
Yeah, I think it comes down to just, it feels like to get work done, the most effective way is to actually just, like we said, write code or, you know, go ahead and solve the problem. But yeah, most problems we have are not unique problems. Someone's already solved them. And hopefully someone's written a blog post about it recently or a Stack Overflow answer.
Well, the blog post I was looking at today was written in 2013.
That's true, but also how much has Elasticsearch changed in the past 6 years, 7 years?
Yeah, probably not that much. But it, you know, the solution made complete sense, and I was like, oh, it makes sense. It wouldn't be that difficult to change how we have things set up to basically follow their recommended setup, you know? So actually that's what I did today is I swapped. So in a few places, as I mentioned earlier, like our database is the authoritative source for data, and Elasticsearch, it's not really a cache, so to speak, because we use it for faceted searching, but Elasticsearch isn't the authoritative source. It gets its source information from the database, right? But there are a few places in our app where, like, say, for example, like a store admin in the inventory system, the search would be powered by Elasticsearch. And that meant that, you know, if a person's modifying their inventory, then the Elasticsearch data has to be updated immediately, unless otherwise, you know, otherwise they think that the system's not updating the product, not saving it correctly. And we've had a few people mention when Elasticsearch takes more than a couple of minutes to actually update this product. And that could be because a lot of people are searching, could be various reasons, right? Elasticsearch even says, if you're updating a row every time it changes, that's not the best way to do it, because of a lot of technical reasons I won't go into. I'll link the blog post, but we've actually had a couple people notice, like, oh, I tried to change this and it didn't change, but then like 2 minutes later it was correct. Well, it's because the form that you changed saved it to the database, and then it had everything had to go through the pipes for Elasticsearch to update, right? So basically today what I did, and I'm surprised I was able to do it just in a few hours, like I swapped all those views out to be pulling information from the database. And so that way I'm able to change how we're pushing data to Elasticsearch. And surprisingly enough, the endpoint that I already had for searching for products from the database actually had feature parity enough for the inventory searching anyway, with the Elasticsearch endpoint. So ended up swapping out some JavaScript, and now I'm free to decouple the product context and the Elasticsearch context.
That's awesome. I know we talked about this earlier today. I didn't realize, A, that you had gotten so far, and B, that, yeah, you just get to reuse that API. Because, I mean, you spent a lot of time fleshing that out and making sure it was pretty complete. And obviously, without even anticipating it, you already, you know, it already had a large enough scope to fix this problem as well.
Yeah. So, it, like I said, I didn't have to change. Well, I don't think I mentioned this on the air yet, but I mentioned to you earlier that I didn't require, there were zero changes to the API required for this swapping of product searching, or the endpoint that the product data is coming from for store admins. So that was nice.
I love it.
Yeah, that was nice. But then, you know, people won't have to see, they won't. So there's like that a jarring feeling, right? Like if you're modifying your inventory, like, oh, this thing's actually sold out, let me set it to zero, click save, go back to the listing. Oh, it says one still. What the heck? You know, that's just gone. One thing that I thought was really interesting, in the article that Elastic wrote, I'll put this in the show notes, but they basically said, like, you know, there's a trade-off that you have to make. Like, how much is it worth your business to have data available near real-time via, in Elasticsearch, that is, versus, you know, are you able to get away with, you know, can it be 5 minutes before it's up to date? Can it be 15? Can it be a week? Can it be a month? You know, like, what does it mean to your business at that point? I never really thought about it, because my default was, again, and what I learned with the Search Kick Jam was, it's just up to date all the way automatically. So in my mind this whole time, it's like, if Elasticsearch isn't up to date right away, then that's an issue that we have to solve, when in reality it's not. So I talked to Lindsay and I explained to her, hey, you know, like, once I make this change to the inventory searching, how long does it matter to you if how soon product updates are available in the search, or product like the new information is available in the search? Like, is 2 minutes okay? Is 10 minutes okay? And she was like, yeah, 10 minutes is probably fine. You know, when last week I would have thought, like, that's unacceptable, you know?
So the search operation and the actual sort of editing and listing operations, those are now completely decoupled, in the sense that, like, again, if you update a product, that chain is reflected instantly in most places except for search. Is that right?
Yeah. So, I mean, they're already sort of decoupled anyway. So let's say that I'm changing a product, and I change a piece of information and it hasn't yet updated in Elasticsearch, and you're shopping, and you add it to your cart, the cart data is going to be reflecting information from the database, not Elasticsearch anyway. So really the only place we were using Elasticsearch for is literally faceted searching, using, you know, Elasticsearch scoring and all that stuff that is good at, right? So using that stuff, but everywhere else in the application is just pulling data from the database anyway. So really all we're using Elasticsearch for is its scoring algorithms so it also does, like, you know, synonyms, and it can know, like, if you spell sofa wrong, or like if you say couch, if you type in couch, it knows to match a sofa as well, for example. It has a lot of smartness to it.
Can I make a maybe dumb suggestion that hopefully you thought of? Sorry, I phrased that poorly.
What's that?
When you do a search and you get those results, is everything in there fed directly from Elasticsearch in terms of, like, titles and prices and inventory? All the stuff is from Elasticsearch, right?
Yes.
It doesn't touch the database. So why couldn't you just use Elasticsearch to give me, do the search, get all that contextual, cool, plain text, awesome searching stuff, but then just get a list of IDs and then fetch the stuff from the database?
So I actually thought about this a few times. And I lied to you a little bit. So
no, Sean.
So when you perform right now, when you search, when you send a GraphQL request and you send, or you hit the or use the Elasticsearch products query, Elasticsearch will return results with all of the information, right? And then what happens right now, and this is just because I haven't needed to make this not happen, but what happens right now is because Absinthe is going to take that data, it's just by default it's going to push it through the resolvers, right? So both happen. So Elasticsearch returns the information, and then that information goes through the resolvers in Absinthe anyway. So there's not really any extra database calls. It just sort of, like, passes through there. So Absinthe might augment it a little bit, but so I thought about just returning IDs a couple of times, actually. So you're literally just relying on it to do the searching goodness for you. But we still have to index a lot of the stuff, because so for example, like, a product title might be weighted higher than a product description. So we still have to have all that information in Elasticsearch. The only reason I might only return an ID there is to maybe make the payload smaller. But
no, that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is, well, yeah, you still have to keep Elasticsearch up to date. Like, you still want to push the data to Elasticsearch.
Sure.
But when you pull it down and display a result to a user, why not just give them the real thing from the database? Again, Elasticsearch has everything, has all the quote-unquote metadata, but who cares? That metadata might be a few minutes old, but when you actually go to display the results, you could do those in real time. Have those be real data from the database. That way, it's, like, kind of the best of both worlds. And really, then, the only lag is, oh, my search might be a little bit weird. Like, if I change couch to sofa or something, maybe it won't show up for a few minutes. But at least if it does show up, the price is right.
Yeah, no, I think we're sort of, like, dancing around each other, because that's actually really sort of what's happening here because of Absinthe resolvers. So Elasticsearch is going to return its data, and every field goes through Absinthe resolver. I guess, like, if a title hasn't been updated, it's still going to, you know, eventually do map.get on the title, which is Elasticsearch data, but a few other fields that might be, like, associated data. So for example, we're not indexing, like, store data on each product document in Elasticsearch. So it's sort of a hybrid of the two things happening right now. I don't know. Like, it works well enough for now. I haven't been motivated enough to spend, like, to sort of try to iron that out more, but it could definitely be something I look at in the future. Especially thinking about performance, if I want to try to, you know, make payloads smaller and things like that.
Okay. And so the solution you ended up landing on was this batching solution, right?
So I guess I can back up a little bit and talk about, like, why Elasticsearch says that updating rows one by one isn't a great idea. And it's specifically because of how Elasticsearch works, or how it's architected. And so you have... Okay, well, let's say we have a product. We have a product document, and we have product mappings. And so in Elasticsearch, if you have a product mapping, so you might have, like, a title, you might have description, you might have a bunch of different types of fields. And what an Elasticsearch mapping does is allow you to map a field to a data type, and based on the data type, Elasticsearch can do different things, whether it's numeric, whether it's string-based, or, you know, it has a bunch of different functionality that can happen based on the type of the mapping that's set up. So if you send an update request for a specific document, documents can actually be mutated. So it has to analyze the information you're sending it, and it has to make a new document and replace the old document, which is can be a pretty heavy operation if you have lots of mappings happening. And so just imagine if you have 10 people editing their inventories and clicking save on a product, well, then those 10 people are sending 10 individual products over to Elasticsearch. Each 10 of those individual documents get analyzed and overwrite the old one. And so if that happens a lot, as you grow, your CPU usage is going to grow because your server is going to constantly be analyzing documents. But on top of that, it could actually degrade performance. So if you have, say, a lot of people editing their inventory at once and a spike of people come to actually search for products, the customers, if you have lots of inventory being analyzed, well, you could actually make it slower, like the requests will be slower depending on your server to the customers on the other side, right? And so because of this, Elasticsearch actually does a lot of optimizations around batch updates. So if you sent all 10 of those product updates at once, Elasticsearch can sort of batch this thing, and it's going to, it's sort of like your N plus one query problem, right? And solving that by using something like Data Loader. So if you batch the 10 updates into one SQL run, or operation, it's going to be much more performant, right? And more resource friendly to your machine. And Elasticsearch is the same way. So if you send them a batch, they can optimize the writing and the analyzing and do a batch update in one operation. Okay. So that's sort of like why they say it's not a great, it's sort of an anti-pattern to have one by one row updates into your Elasticsearch index. And so one thing I had been thinking about, I actually had a call with a friend the other day, and I had been thinking about changing how DK works to using this queue system as opposed to like one-off updates. Turns out that on reading this article, it's very similar to what they recommend, but they essentially recommend doing things in windows. So if it's okay for your business, say like every 10 minutes, you could run a job that looks for any products that have been updated in the last 10 minutes, and you can run a single batch update request to your Elasticsearch server to update all those products at once. So that way, you're batching the updates. It's more performance, better for your server. You're not clogging the pipe, so to speak, I guess, and taking resources away from customers. So that's essentially the approach I'm working on now, because the database is truly the source for any product data that needs to be like up to date, I guess, quote unquote, real time. That means that it's perfectly okay for us to only update our Elasticsearch index every 2 or 5 or 10 minutes or whatever. We're going to use the window approach where we have a job that runs every, say, 10 minutes, gets all updated products. Say there's 10,000, I don't know, I'll just run over the IDs, batch them into chunks of 500, and just put them in a job queue and let them run in the background.
I still think the ID thing, returning the ID thing, is going to be the right way to go, but we can, we'll take it offline and discuss it later.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy. Like when you build out this kind of system, you don't think of those kind of limitations because of just the way you've worked before. You know, you said the, what was the Ruby gem called?
The search kick gem, yes.
But yeah, you work at a certain scale and you, that's hard to anticipate those problems if you don't have a really good understanding of all those underlying systems. But now you do, and it makes sense once you, I don't want to say it again, but hindsight's 20/20, right? Like, now you know, you don't know what you don't know, and so it's a fairly simple solution when you look at it from the outside. It's like, oh yeah, just do this, but of course, you have to understand all the pieces to even understand why you have to do it that way.
Sure, and to be clear, I don't want to say, like, search kick is doing it wrong. That's not what I'm trying to say at all. Because it's battle tested. It's been around for a long time. It worked well enough for me. It's just that when I didn't have a library to fall back on that just did that stuff for me, it forced me to sort of research. And really, I guess what led me to having to research this stuff is A, our Elasticsearch provider doesn't support concurrent indexing. So, you know, sending the one by one thing is a crapshoot anyway, because there's some level of chance, a high level of chance, that if two people click save at the same time, then one of the index updates is going to get dropped anyway. So there's that. So that pushed me into looking, having to rely on some sort of batch updating mechanism, which we have. In fact, most of the functionality for this already exists. All I have to do is create a job that schedule these updates and tear out the function calls from the product context. But the other part that pushed me into that was seeing occasional timeouts happening and working on this other big feature with vendor products and having to constantly think, okay, well, how does this affect the Elasticsearch index updating? And where do I need to put the function calls to make sure the index is updated properly? That was sort of always a pain. Again, I've been harping on this idea of layered architecture for a while now, and digging through this book, I came to the realization, like, oh, they shouldn't be coupled like this together at all. That led me to Google that, you know, Google for blog posts this morning at the dog park, which led me to an actual solution.
There you go, man. System works.
System works. So, yeah, I mean, I can report back on how this affects things, but really, like, it'll be nice because I feel like anytime you're able to drop like a bunch of explicit dependencies between pieces in your application, right? Like whenever you're able to remove a bunch of dependencies in your application, I mean like modules depending on other modules, I think it's probably a good thing.
It's not so much, I don't think it's so much the dependency itself, but it's the surface area of that dependency, right? If it's one function call, That's typically, because obviously your modules still have to relate to each other somehow. Otherwise, you're not building something. Yeah, and that's a big tenet of like object-oriented design. I'm sure the domain-driven design book circles around that idea as well.
Yeah, it definitely does. And I mean, I was also reading another blog post today by Stefan Bussey. He's the author of the Real-Time Phoenix book that I got recently and have yet to read, but I'm looking forward to it. But one of the things that he wrote is a blog post called Useful Elixir Patterns from a real world side project. And it's cool because he actually like shared some code snippets in there. But one of the things he talks about is how he uses his context. And he also sort of talks about how it's difficult sometimes to explore ideas and learn when you're working on the same project every day, because you don't want to like learn the wrong thing in the hard way on a project that you're working on every day. Sometimes a side project you can sort of push the boundaries, right, and do things in sort of an extreme way in order to see if it's tenable for your more stable job, I suppose. But one thing that he mentioned, and I'll read sort of a little snippet here, is contexts, at least as I use them, are all about establishing an application domain and keeping the interfaces small and useful for other parts of the system to use. He says, I've done this in the past, but really pushed for it for this project by having no function usage other than top-level modules. That really kind of goes along with the other Elixir article I've been rereading, the application layering, I think it was called. I'll put links to these in the show notes. But basically, in that article, too, this person was saying he doesn't allow himself to call, he only allows himself to use top level functions from sibling modules. There's no sort of one module up here traversing three generations deep for a function over there. Like, he doesn't allow it to happen. That's all under the guise of having a simple interface, right? So you're sort of designing the interfaces for you to work with and make that nice. And if I'm thinking about a design collective, that's definitely an area where I've shot myself in the foot before, is like just calling nested functions willy-nilly all over the place. And not really, what that really does to me is force me not to think about the interface at all. There's a function down here, let me get at it. But that doesn't force me to think about, should I be getting at this function? Is there a different way I should be doing this? Should these two systems even know about each other at all?
Yeah, that's funny. That goes back to Demeter's Law, which we talked about at some point recently. But again, object-oriented principle that follows the same thing. It's like you shouldn't be hitting dot more than once when you're in this chain of function calls. And it's kind of funny because in like modules technically, Elixir modules, there's no hierarchy. Like, a module just has a name. Name just happens to have dots in it, which implies some kind of hierarchy. But you can literally call whatever function on, and, you know, that's public on whatever module you want. And there's no private modules, for example, which I kind of wish there was. Like, I wish there was some kind of, like, at least give me, like, a, I don't know, folder private scope, or, like, a, they probably would never happen, but at least a dependency level private scope. That's a whole other discussion. But I think, in general, people are just afraid to make modules. Like, people just like, oh, I've got a context, just put everything in there. And, like, that's great, but man, it makes it really hard to, like, identify and pick out individual concepts that are sort of internal to that context, because contexts are complicated. Like, if you think of them as each individual little applications or businesses or domains or whatever,
mm-hmm.
sure, the API into them is supposed to be simple, but there's a lot of complex functionality underneath. And I've been thinking more and more, and I haven't tried this yet, but next time I get a chance to dig into the Elixir portion of RHR, I'm going to take a stab at, like, explicitly calling modules like context name dot internal or dot private or something like that. Like, have a namespace to put all that crap that doesn't look and feel like if it should be throwawayable.
Sure.
Disposable. It should be disposable. I think explicitly calling out in the name is just a big flag to that, like, hey, like, you should not be dot private dot whatever from some other module. Like, no, stay away. Something's wrong.
Yeah, that's interesting.
And it seems a little heavy-handed, but, and it's not as clean as calling, like, you know, context name dot submodule name, but you shouldn't really, you can just alias it anyways, like, you know. So that's something I've been thinking about, just kind of a thought experiment. Maybe it's something you could try when you start doing this layering stuff.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. There's a lot of code I can delete. Like I said, in Design Collective, we haven't used a lot of metaprogramming or extrapolating of things. It's sort of just been brute force making modules, and that's fine. It's easy to refactor and stuff. But thinking about that sort of stuff, especially, I've always said that I sort of like some rules, and that's one thing that I always felt like I struggled with, especially with Phoenix Context, was, okay, I get the basic premise of domain-driven design, but I guess I haven't researched enough or looked around enough for, like, okay, so what are some rules that I can follow? And maybe, like, only using top-level functions, you know, like, not going more than one space namespace deep, maybe that's difficult, more difficult in practice than it should be, or maybe the idea is nice, but in practice it's probably not, you know, maybe not something that's, like, realistic. That's sort of how I felt when I first looked at it, was like, that doesn't feel like it's realistic.
You know what this reminds me of is, I was having a discussion in the Slack today. Someone was pretty new to Phoenix, and I think just web development in general, and they didn't really understand REST and how, like, what that meant and how it worked in terms of routes and HTTP methods and that kind of stuff. Then, of course, that has to start the whole pragmatic discussion, like, is REST even worth it? Does it work in the real world? Who actually uses it? And basically what it comes down to, and I think this is true, is that it only works in the very most ideal of circumstances, but it pretty much falls apart very quickly after that. And that most people, most APIs that you consume are not really REST. Like, they're REST-ish. They're not RESTful. They're just kind of, maybe they're just napping. And crack myself up. So, and same thing, like, maybe read the domain-driven design book, and you're like, oh, there's some cool ideas in there, but, like, you don't have to follow the letter of the law. It's not like the ghost of some computer science developer is going to rise up and haunt you or something.
I wish they would. part of, like, so I've had a few people over, I don't know, the years ask me, like, why are you so interested in reading this book or that book, or, you know, why are you asking about this or that? You know, is it's only, maybe you probably don't have to follow the letter of the law in those things, but in my mind, exposing myself to this information is almost as much about what not to do. And I think that's what's exceedingly useful to me in looking at this stuff, is, okay, this is one thing I did and it sucked, and, you know, so it's sort of like learning from other people's mistakes, like looking at prior work, looking at mistakes that had been made so I can avoid those, and sort of help me at least steer farther to the right direction.
I like that. And it's not so much that I messed up. It's identifying why, like where the shortcoming is in your design that you did before. Like, oh, recognizing, oh, maybe I shouldn't have dove in three levels of nested modules to pull out this thing, because now it's tightly coupled and it's a pain to uncouple that. I should have designed a better interface, a different interface. Maybe it's a new context. Maybe, like, that stuff comes with experience, or you can just read a book and learn from someone else's experience way quicker.
Sure. Yeah. That's what I'm trying to do. And the other thing is, like, terminology too. You can't find answers if you don't know the terms to look for. And that's been really helpful to me, I suppose, in picking up these books lately is, oh, this is what that pattern is called, or this is what this technique is called. And I'm able to find more useful information on it relatively quickly, because if you don't know what to ask, how can you possibly get an answer?
Absolutely.
So 40 minutes later, that's what I've been up to.
And now on to the show.
Yeah. But I mean, like, at the end of the day, it feels good, I suppose. Like, it doesn't feel like a chore anymore, which is great. We'll see how long we can keep this momentum going.
Keep it up. It's so funny to me. I was thinking about this too while you were talking. The new year, January 1st, is such a, it's kind of an artificial thing. Like, I saw a question somewhere on Reddit, or I think it was like, why are you waiting until the new year's to improve yourself? Like, you can start today. And so there's this, I'm just trying to understand the psychology of, like, why the beginning of the year has this sort of feeling of a new start or a new beginning. Like, it's the same problems we had last week. It's just this week now.
Right.
It definitely is a thing, but it shouldn't be. Like, it doesn't make sense to me that it's not logical. You know, you could say that any day is a new beginning, your birthday or, I don't know, Saturnalia, you know, whatever you want.
I think for me, it was just a clean break, some time off. That's what really helped.
That's true. I mean, the time off definitely helps. But you can have, like, summer break, too. Come back feeling good after that. You live in California, so every day is, like, summer vacation there.
Yeah, I suppose. That's true. It's pretty spoiled here. I mean, one thing that we're trying to do now is just be more conscious about taking time like that. So we're doing this thing called the Six Peak Challenge. I think it's called the Six Peak Challenge. It's like a thing. They have it for the whole, like, a bunch of different regions in the U.S. So there's, like, Arizona, Northern California, Southern California. There's even one, a New England one, Rockwell.
We don't have real mountains here.
Right. That's what I've been telling people the whole time I was in Vermont, and they didn't want to listen to me. So, but basically, yeah, it's like six hikes, six climbs or whatever. And so we're working on that this year, trying to do all six. We're actually doing the first one on Jamie's birthday with some friends. We're doing, what's the first one here? We're doing Mount Amunahum? Mount Amunahum, I think it's called. Yeah, you try to say that.
Mount Amunahum. Damn it. Wait, it costs money?
If you want to get, like, if you want to have, like, their hike tracker and stuff.
You could just go outside.
Right.
It's free to go outside.
Yeah. But if you want to, like, participate in their thing, it's like $30 or something like that. But yeah, definitely trying to be more thoughtful about, you know, making time, taking those breaks, not letting the stress pile up.
Yeah, and you gotta enforce those boundaries, right? You gotta make sure that the work doesn't slowly come creeping back into that time. I'll check you if I see you working. If I see you in Discord and Spotify's playing on a Saturday...
Spotify's playing?
I'm going to chastise you. That happened to me the other day. It was a Saturday, and my friend messaged me on Discord, and he's like, Rockwell, why are you working? And I was. Like, he's like, I'm like, how did you know I was working? He's like, I could see you're playing Spotify. Damn it. I've been had. Now I just listen to vinyl, so no one can know.
No one's going to know, yeah. I hear you got a new chunk of aluminum recently. Aluminium.
It's more of a slab, really. Aluminium, yes. Johnny Ive would be disappointed. So, yeah, a couple weeks ago, we had our annual, semi-annual business retreat up at one of our ham radio stations up in the Catskills of New York. It was beautiful area, nice and remote, and get the wood stove cranking and just hang out and yell at each other. but productive yelling though.
Sure.
And Lee got a bunch of great little gifts for us. He got us we have a new logo, and because our logo was crap and we had it for way too long, we got this great new logo. And so we got some mugs with our call signs on it and the logo, and some backpacks that have, you know, they're the nice huge, like, they're gigantic. I forget the brand, but you would know it if you saw it. And he got our logo embroidered on it. So he hands me the backpack, and I'm like, this is a heavy backpack. And I open it up, and sure enough, there's a 16-inch MacBook Pro in there, which I was not expecting, but was kind of, I don't want to say two-faced, but, like, he just wanted my old 13-inch, because I got the one with the good keyboard from 2013.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think he had some ulterior motives there. But anyway, new 16-inch MacBook Pro, space gray or whatever the black color is. It's my first experience with Catalina, because I still hadn't installed it anything yet. So that was fun. Oh my God, the sound on it. Like, this is probably old news to everyone. I don't want to go into, like, a full tech review, but my God, the speakers, it's something else. You're sitting in front of it, and it sounds like the sound's coming from behind you. I don't know how they do that. It's really, really, really amazing. And the bass, too. Oh, man, I don't know. They're doing some crazy HomePod stuff in there, but it's I was not expecting that. It's a nice little perk, you know? It's not still laptop speakers, but nicer than I expected, so that's kind of a nice little surprise.
Well, I mean, I think everyone wants to know, really, how's that keyboard?
Oh, man, those inverted arrows. The inverted T arrows.
Oh, it has inverted T arrows?
Inverted T arrows, yes.
Yeah, but why are the left and right buttons so small? I'll leave it at that. But how is it travel? How is it typing on it? How is it actual, like, using it every day?
So you have to remember, I'm coming from a 2013. I had no experience with any of the Butterfly Key keyboards, but I mean, these are, they feel great. They're snappy. It just feels like a tighter version of the old Chiclet keys, and I think it's fine. I've just, like, zero complaints with the keyboard. I mean, it's a laptop keyboard. It's going to be what it is. It's not my nice ergonomic sculpt. And because it's the 16-inch, it's really far away. Like, you got to reach for it, mm-hmm. you know? Because there's a lot of space. That trackpad is the size of my hand. Like, it's bigger than my hand. I could put my whole hand on the trackpad.
Yeah, that's one of the things I actually liked about the 15-inch that I have, is the trackpad is gigantic.
Yeah, yeah, definitely fine. Like, dragging and pinching and zooming and stuff it's definitely nice to have that extra real estate. And I think just the size in general was, like, it's just not nearly as big as I thought it was going to be. I mean, it's only a hair bigger than the 15-inch, and I think it's totally fine just chilling on the couch or, you know, whatever. I don't mind lugging it around. I don't have a problem with that, and I never travel, really, so I don't have to worry about airplanes and that whole thing. But the size is good. I'm actually surprised by how compact it is for being a 16-inch laptop. I also think I might have just bricked it.
Oh, no.
Well, while we're sitting here, I installed the latest Catalina update, and it's restarted. The touch bar is active, which touch bar, I know there's a lot of haters. I think it's pretty cool. I've been playing with Logic, and depending on which instrument you select in Logic, has a totally different set of controls on the touch bar.
Yeah.
For controlling all the different sliders, and it has a little, like, drum pad, so you can do all the different drum beats, and you can even do, like, a keyboard on the touch. It's very customizable, and there's all different layers, depending if you hold Option, Command, Control, Shift, whatever. It, you know, basically swaps the function keys in and out to whatever modifier you're pressing down, so that's cool.
Yeah, it's pretty nice. I don't use it a whole lot. I have mine set to the function rows by default, so I have to hold down the function key to get to the touch bar control strip.
Oh, that's too bad. I instantly put the shortcut for the screenshot button, because I can never remember the right incantation for different versions of screenshots.
Command-Shift-4, Command-Shift-5.
Yeah, I know, but what if I want to go to the clipboard instead of the desktop? What if I want to do a screen recording? What if I want to do a section of a window? What if I want to do full screen? Okay, it did. I had to hard turn it off, but it did come back.
That's good. Thank God. I think we're all holding our breath for you there.
What else? I got to live the USB-C lifestyle now, so that's a thing. not looking forward to that, but I will say, first impressions, being able to put the power cord on either side, thumbs up. MagSafe and the LED indicator for charging, thumbs down, because that's gone, and I'm sad.
Right.
But, you know, at least when you plug it in, it makes a little, it makes the same noise that the iPhone makes when you plug it in, which I did not realize.
Chong.
Yeah. It does a lot of stuff while it's asleep.
Yeah, it does. It really, really does. That was... I keep thinking about this clip I saw on YouTube of Joe Rogan interviewing Snowden, and Snowden was like, or no, yes, Joe was like, well, I can just turn my phone off, right? Like, if I don't want people listening to me, I can just turn my phone off. And Snowden was like, how do you know your phone's off?
Mm-hmm.
And Rogan's face just kind of went white. It was funny. But yeah, the phones and the computers do so much stuff while they're sleeping.
Now the screen just went black again.
Well,
like for no reason.
Might as well. It sounds like you're taking a trip to the Apple Store tomorrow. Hopefully not.
It is pretty great to have a laptop that is now as fast and faster than my 27-inch desktop iMac, which is a 4 gigahertz i7 versus a 2.6 gig. Yeah, I ran the Geekbench scores, and it's obviously it exceeds it in cores because it's got 6 cores instead of 4, and even single-threaded, it meets or exceeds it. So
those numbers mean nothing to me. So
I don't know. It's just they're neck and neck compared to the old MacBook, which was, you know, chugging.
That's pretty cool, though. I'm glad that you've got it all set up, and it seems like a nice machine. I'll probably wait a while longer before I upgrade mine, but. Seems like they're on the right track, right? Apple, that is?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the 13/14, whatever, is going to be a big one for them, I think. I think that's inevitable.
Mm-hmm.
Man, now I'm worried. Now this thing is jinxed. You jinxed it.
I did not.
I had to do this update, and now it's all screwy.
I'm knocking on my table for you.
Oh, one other thing I wanted to mention was that, like, of course I always start my laptops, pretty much all my computers, from scratch, fresh. I don't do migration assisted or anything. And, man, I really did not enjoy setting my dev environment again. Like, I'm at this point where I've got experimented with a lot of different technologies. I've got RVM for doing my Ruby version management from, you know, since I've done forever. Now I've got ASDF in the mix, which I basically just use for NPM and... you know, Elixir and Erlang at this point. But then I've got, like, some of the DK stuff with Dockerized, so I haven't even set that up.
Mm.
And there's all these different things, and then Xcode and Homebrew and get my terminal stuff and dot files and SSH keys and yada yada. Like, it's just, I don't do it frequently enough for me to try to automate this or, like, you know, it's just, I just do things as I come up. But, man, it's so, I hate that friction of, like, I just want to get work done, but I have to do these like 5 other steps before I can even get to that point. And I don't always remember the right incantations or what exactly I need.
Yeah, it's a lot of stuff.
That's frustrating to me. And I know like the Docker people are probably yelling at me right now or the Vagrant people, the Vagrants.
Nice.
I don't know, man. Whatever. I just like, I just want a good local native development experience.
Yeah, I think that's why I've standardized pretty much everything on ADSDF by now. It's got some rough edges, but it is what it is, and I don't have to mess with it too much.
Yeah, that's what I need to do. I just have projects spanning multiple years that I need to just normalize on something.
Sure. Yeah, I think there's a few, I'm sure you wouldn't want to do this, but I think there's a few setup scripts out there. Like, I think Thoughtbot has a repo for new laptops where you basically run a couple of shell files and it downloads and installs everything for you.
In an earlier lifetime, I had a site called newmacapps.info, which was a curated list of free and open source applications that you might want to install on your new computer. And I even had a little checkbox so you could show only open source if you're into that. And it was just a list of the latest versions. They're just direct download links, so you could just go through and pick whatever you wanted. There was even that, what was that program called that would like make a package for you? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Mm.
Oh, this is gonna kill me.
I don't think so.
It's called Ninite. Wow, pulled that out. Ninite.
How's that spelled?
Ninite. This might actually be only a Windows thing.
I was gonna say that progress bar in the screenshot.
But there was a version, there was a thing like this for macOS, I think, as well.
This is interesting. Maybe I didn't know this existed.
Yeah, but this is a cool one where you can just kind of click through and it just makes a little installer for you if you trust it. Yeah, it is what it is. Like I said, I don't get new computers often enough for it to care. I mean, this has been a good 6 or 7 years. Had a good run. I still have the original box and all the original plastic wrap and packaging and stuff, so I installed Catalina, wiped the drive, wiped everything down with isopropyl alcohol, get all my nasty bodily
secretions
deposits out of all the nooks and crannies. I don't want to say secretions, but, you know, dead skin cells and who knows what else. It's a good computer. I'm going to miss it. I'm going to miss being able to travel and just plug the HDMI cable right into a TV and play Jackbox Party Pack or Drawful.
You'll need a second aluminum box for that.
It keeps booting into a black screen now. Type in my password and then the screen just goes black. No touch bar.
That's not good. That's happening live too, on the air, in real time. That's a bummer. Well, I can leave you to that if you want to figure out what's going on there.
Yeah, I better go do something about this.
Well, if anyone hears this and has any suggestions for Rockwell,
10.15.2, I think was the update.
10.15.2. What am I on right now? 10.15.2. Well, if anyone wants to send kind wishes and warmest regards to Rockwell, I think he would appreciate that.
You can send those to me on Twitter at Shrockwell. Or you can tweet us at the show, DNCcast, and Sean is Sean Washbot.
Everything that I mentioned today, all these articles and books and things, are going to be in the show notes, and those will be available at dnc.show. So if there's anything that sounded interesting, a piece of code that I mentioned, as soon as I get back to Go, I'm going to be getting my blog off the ground, so maybe I'll write about some of this Elasticsearch stuff and DDD things with Elixir. But for now, you just have to go to dnc.show to see what we've been talking about.
Wasn't that that character from Smash Brothers, King DDD?
I don't recall.
Maybe he was just a developer at heart. We'll also post the show notes over on spectrum.chat. You can see us there chatting. Come say hi. Click on things.
I'm putting more bits into the cloud over there. And as always, thanks to Spec for having us and putting us out there and helping us spread the gospel that is Elixir. It always makes me happy when people message me and say that they got into Elixir through the show. So thanks to Spec for making that possible.
And thanks to you, Sean, for making this possible. Because I couldn't do this by myself. No one wants to listen to that.
I'd listen to it.
You'd just be yelling the whole time. No, what is he talking about? Don't do that. All right, man. Well, have a good rest of your week, and we'll talk later.
All right. Good luck with the laptop.
Pray for me.
Look at memories growing up.